Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita, planting the seed. On off nights, his apartment was quiet. This is all 26 Second Avenue, right in the beginning. He might remain alone for the whole evening, typing and translating Srimad Bhagavatam, or talking in a relaxed atmosphere to just one or two guests until 10. But on meeting nights, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, there was activity in every room of his apartment. He wasn't alone anymore. His new followers were helping him, and they shared in his spirit of trying to get people to chant Hare Krishna and hear of Krishna consciousness. In the back room, he worked on his translation of the Bhagavatam, or spoke with guests up until 6, when he would go to take his bath. Sometimes he would have to wait until the bathroom was free. He had introduced his young followers to the practice of taking 2 baths a day, and now he was sometimes inconvenienced by having to share his bathroom. Tribhuvanath Prabhu, well, you knew him personally, I imagine.
You knew him better than me.
I knew him for sure. He was, telling us he was with Prabhupada in Scotland, 72. And they had a center in Edinburgh. But it was only one bathroom. And Prabhupada, and so there was a little queue. It weren't a lot of devotees, but, you know, with some visitors, maybe there was 10 or so young men. So they would queue, and Prabhupada would queue with them. And sometimes someone would say, "Oh, please come forward." But sometimes they wouldn't. And Prabhupada didn't say anything. And that was where Prabhupada famously was shaving one morning. He didn't have any shaving equipment at all. So he asked, whoever, one of the young men for some shaving foam or some soap and a shaver. And it was provided. And so, a bit of soap and then shaving. And Prabhupada's looking at the thing and trying to shave and looking at the thing. It wasn't working well. And trying to shave again and looking at it. And then Prabhupada, opened it and looked at it more carefully and said, "This is not Gillette. This is bogus." After his bath, he would come into the front room where his assembled followers would sit around him. He would sit on a mat facing his picture of the Panchatattva, and after putting a few drops of water in his left palm from a small metal spoon and bowl, he would rub a lump of Vrindavan clay in the water, making a wet paste. He would then apply the clay markings of Vaishnav Tilak, dipping into the yellowish paste in his left hand with the ring finger of his right. Means this, is it?
Yes.
It's this finger.
Yes.
Okay. Right. Ring finger. He would scrape wet clay from his palm, and while looking into a small mirror, which he held definitely between the thumb and pinky of his left hand, he would mark a vertical clay strip up his forehead, and then trim the clay into 2 parallel lines by placing the little finger of his right hand between his eyebrows and running it upward past the hairline. clearing a path in the still moist clay. That's a lesson. Then he marked 11 other places on his body while the boy sat observing, sometimes asking questions or sometimes speaking their own understandings of Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada, my Guru Maharaj used to put on tilak without a mirror. Devotee, did it come out neat? Prabhupada, neat or not, that does not matter. Yes, it was also neat. Yeah, I remember we were on Padayatra, 91, I think, 91, in England. And we would also put on tilak without a mirror. Just got into the habit. And, you know, sometimes there'd be a vehicle there, sometimes there wouldn't. So you just look in the window and say that, it's okay. It's not too bad. Prabhupada would then silently recite the Gayatri Mantra, holding his Brahman sacred thread and looping it around his right thumb. He would sit erect, silently moving his lips. His bare shoulders and arms were quite thin, as was his chest, but he had a round, slightly protruding belly. His complexion was as satiny smooth as a young boy's, except for his face, which bore signs of age. The movements of his hands were methodical, aristocratic, yet delicate. He picked up two brass bells in his left hand and began ringing them, too. Then after lighting two sticks of incense from the candle near the picture of Lord Chaitanya and his associates, he began waving the incense slowly in small circles before Lord Chaitanya while still ringing the bells. He looked deeply at the picture and continued cutting spirals of fragrant smoke, all the while ringing the bells. None of the boys knew what he was doing, although he did it every evening. But it was a ceremony. It meant something. The boys began to call the ceremony bells. After bells, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, it would usually be time for the evening kirtan. Some of the devotees would already be downstairs greeting guests and explaining about the Swami and the chanting. But without the Swami, nothing could begin. No one knew how to sing or drum, and no one dared think of leading the mantra chanting without him. Only when he entered at 7 o'clock would they begin. Freshly showered and dressed in his clean Indian hand-woven cloth, his arms and body decorated with the arrow-like Vaishnav markings, Prabhupada would leave his apartment and go downstairs to face another ecstatic opportunity to glorify Krishna. The tiny temple would be crowded with wild, unbrahminical, candid young Americans. Dawn was a test of Swamiji's tolerance. He'd lived in the storefront for months, working little and not trying to change his habits. He had a remarkable speech affectation. Instead of talking, he enunciated his words as if he were reciting them from a book. And he never used contradictions. It wasn't that he was intellectual, just that somehow he had developed a plan to abolish his natural dialect. Don's speech struck people as bizarre, like it might be the result of too many drugs. It gave him the air of being not an ordinary human and not an ordinary being. And he continuously took marijuana, even after Swamiji had asked those who lived with him not to. Sometimes during the day his girlfriend would join him in the storefront, and they would sit together talking intimately and sometimes kissing. But he liked the Swami. He even gave some money once. He liked living in the storefront, and Swamiji didn't complain. But others did. One day, an interested newcomer dropped by the storefront and found Don alone, surrounded by the sharp aroma of marijuana. "You've been smoking pot, but the Swami doesn't want anyone smoking here." Don denied it. "I have not been smoking. You are not speaking the truth." The boy then reached in Don's shirt pocket and pulled out a joint, and Don hit him in the face. Several of the boys found out. They weren't sure what was right. What would the Swami do? What do you do if someone smokes pot? Even though a devotee was not supposed to, could it be allowed sometimes? They put the matter before Swamiji. Prabhupada took it very seriously, and he was upset, especially about the violence. "He hit you?" he asked the boy. "I will go down myself and kick him in the head." But then Prabhupada thought about it and said that Don should be asked to leave. But Don had already left. The next morning, during Swamiji's class, Don appeared at the front door. From his dais, Swamiji looked out at Don with great concern. But his first concern was for ISKCON. "Ask him," Prabhupada requested Roy, who sat nearby, "if he has marijuana, then he cannot come in. Our society..." Prabhupada was like an anxious father, afraid for the life of his infant ISKCON. Roy went to the door and told Don he would have to give up his drugs if he entered. And Don walked away. Raphael was not interested in spiritual discipline. He was a tall young man with long straight brown hair who, like Don, tried to stay aloof and casual towards Swamiji. When Prabhupada introduced japa and encouraged the boys to chant during the day, Raphael didn't go for it. He said he liked a good kirtan, but he wouldn't chant on beads. One time, Swamiji was locked out of his apartment, and the boys had to break the lock. Swamiji asked Raphael to replace it. Days went by. Raphael could sit in the storefront reading Rimbaud. He could wander around town, but he couldn't find time to fix the lock. One evening, he dropped by the Swami's apartment, opened the lockless door, and made his way to the back room where some boys were sitting, listening to Swamiji speak informally about Krishna consciousness. Suddenly, Raphael spoke up, expressing his doubts and revealing his distracted mind. "As for me," he said, "I don't know what's happening. I don't know whether a brass band is playing or what the heck is going on." Some of the devotees tensed. He had interrupted their devotional mood. "Raphael is very candid," Swamiji replied, smiling, as if to explain his son's behavior to the others. Raphael finally fixed the lock, but one day after a lecture, he approached the Swami, stood beside the dais, and spoke up, exasperated, impatient. "I'm not meant to sit in the temple and chant on beads. My father was a boxer. I'm meant to run on the beach and breathe in big breaths of air." Raphael went on gesticulating and voicing his familiar complaints, things he would rather do than take up Krishna consciousness. Suddenly, Prabhupada interrupted him in a loud voice. "Then do it! Do it!" Raphael shrank away, but he stayed. Bill Epstein took pride in his relationship with the Swami. It was honest. Although he helped the Swami by telling people about him and sending them up to see him in his apartment, he felt the Swami knew he'd never become a serious follower. Nor did Bill ever mislead himself into thinking he would ever be serious. But Prabhupada wasn't content with Bill's take-it-or-leave-it attitude. When Bill would finally show up at the storefront again after spending some days at a friend's place, only to fall asleep with a blanket wrapped over his head during the lecture, Prabhupada would just start shouting so loud that Bill couldn't sleep. Sometimes Bill would ask a challenging question and Prabhupada would answer and then say, "Are you satisfied?" And Bill would look up dreamily and answer, "No." Then Prabhupada would answer it again more fully and say louder, "Are you satisfied?" And again Bill would say, "No." This would go on until Bill would have to give in. "Yes, yes, I'm satisfied." But Bill was the first person to get up and dance during a kirtan in the storefront. Some of the other boys thought he looked like he was dancing in an egotistical, narcissistic way, even though his arms were outstretched in a facsimile of the pictures of Lord Chaitanya. But when Swamiji saw Bill dancing like that, he looked at Bill with wide open eyes and feelingly expressed appreciation. "Bill is dancing just like Lord Chaitanya." Bill sometimes returned from his wanderings with money, and although it was not very much, he would give it to Swamiji. He liked to sleep at the storefront and spend the day on the street, returning for lunch or kirtans or a place to sleep. He used to leave in the morning and go looking for cigarettes on the ground. To Bill, the Swami was part of the hip movement and had thus earned a place of respect in his eyes as a genuine person. Bill objected when the boys introduced signs of reverential worship toward the Swami, starting with their giving him an elevated seat in the temple. And as the boys who lived with the Swami gradually began to show enthusiasm, competition, and even rivalry among themselves, Bill turned from it in disgust. He allowed that he would just go on help, that he would go on just helping the Swami in his own way. And he knew that the Swami appreciated whatever he did. So he wanted to leave it at that. Carl Jurgens had helped Prabhupada in times of need. He had helped with the legal work of incorporating ISKCON, signed the ISKCON charter as a trustee, and even opened his home to Swamiji when David had driven him from the Bowery loft. But those days when he and Eva had shared their apartment with him had created a tension that had never left. He liked the Swami. He respected him as a genuine sannyasi from India, but he didn't accept the conclusions of the philosophy. The talk about Krishna and the soul was fine, but the idea of giving up drugs and sex was carrying it a little too far. Now Prabhupada was settled in his new place, and Carl decided that he had done his part to help and was no longer needed. Although he had helped Prabhupada incorporate his international society for Krishna consciousness, he didn't want to join it. Carl found the Second Avenue kirtans too public, not like the more intimate atmosphere that he enjoyed with the Swami on the Bowery. Now the audiences were larger, and there was an element of wild letting loose that they had never had on the Bowery. Like some of the other old associates, Carl felt sheepish and reluctant to join in. In comparison to the Second Avenue street scene, the old meetings in the fourth floor Bowery loft had seemed more mystical, like secluded meditations. Carol Becker also preferred a more sedate kirtan. She thought people were trying to take out their personal frustrations by the wild singing and dancing. The few times she did attend evening kirtan on Second Avenue were tense moments. One time a group of teenagers had come into the storefront mocking and shouting, "Hey, what the hell is this?" She kept thinking that at any moment a rock was going to come crashing through the big window. And anyway, her boyfriend wasn't interested. James Green felt embarrassed. He saw that most of the new men were making a serious commitment to the Swami, whereas he could not. He had no bad feeling toward the Swami and his new movement, but he preferred to live alone. He became Yogeshwar. Mm. Yeah, and he's still actively.
He's a professor.
Yeah. He's still actively engaged in ISKCON. Robert Nelson, Prabhupada's old uptown friend, never deviated in his good feelings for Prabhupada. But he always went along in his own natural way and never adopted any serious disciplines. Somehow, almost all of those who'd helped Prabhupada uptown and on the Bowery did not want to go further once he began a spiritual organization, which happened almost immediately after he moved into 26 Second Avenue. New people were coming forward to assist him, and Carl, James, Carol, and others like them felt that they were being replaced and that their obligation toward the Swami was ending. It was a kind of changing of the guard. Although the members of the old guard were still his well-wishers, they began to drift away. I met Robert Nelson. Did you meet Robert Nelson? I met Robert Nelson in our temple in Brooklyn. It must have been 93, first time I went to America. Or was it 92? Anyway, yeah, around that time I met Robert Nelson. So it's many years later. He actually got initiated. He did. By, would you believe, take a guess, Vipramukya. Hare Krishna, such is life. Yeah, but he got initiated. And I met him there. He just walked up to me and started talking about the old days and how he'd been with Prabhupada. He was really nice, kind of heavily built and had that sort of nature, you know. Yeah, easygoing, very easygoing nature. Bruce Schaff, Brahmananda, had just graduated from New York University and was applying for a job. One day an ex-roommate told him about the Swami he had visited down on Second Avenue. "They sing there," his friend said, "and they have this far-out thing where they have some dancing. And Allen Ginsberg was there." The Swami was difficult to understand, his friend explained. And besides that, his followers recorded his talks on a tape recorder. "Why should he have a big tape recorder? That's not very spiritual." But Bruce became interested. Mm. Yeah.
I was speaking to Ramanujacharya and said the first tapes were those big, big tapes.
Oh, yeah.
And they were very expensive. Uh-huh. So after they recorded and transcribed, then they used to erase them.
Yes.
So that's why we don't have the earlys.
Right. That's interesting. The Swami was difficult to understand. I found that. Well, the first lecture I was in at Auckland University, you know, some time before I became a devotee, I struggled to follow it. I struggled. So Bruce Schaff was already a devotee of Indian culture. 4 years ago, when he was barely 20, Bruce had worked during the summer as a steward aboard an American freighter and had gone to India, where he had visited temples bought pictures of Shiva and Ganesh and books on Gandhi, and felt as if he were part of the culture. When he returned to New York University, he read more about India and wrote a paper on Gandhi for his history course. He would eat in Indian restaurants and attend Indian films and music recitals, and he was reading the Bhagavad Gita. He'd even given up eating meat. He had plans of returning to India, taking some advanced college courses, and then coming back to America to teach Eastern religions. But in the meantime, he was experimenting with LSD. I don't know, experimenting, if that's the right word. Just taking it. Chuck Barnett. Is that a Chutananda?
Yes, Chuck. I don't know if that's more than one.
Think it is, but yeah. Anyway, Chuck Barnett was 18 years old. His divorcee mother had recently moved to Greenwich Village, where she was studying psychology at New York University. Chuck had moved out of his mother's apartment to one on 12th Street on the Lower East Side in the neighborhood of Allen Ginsberg and other hip poets and musicians. He was a progressive jazz flutist who worked with several professional groups in the city. He'd been practicing Hatha Yoga for 6 years and had recently been experimenting with LSD. He would have visions of lotuses and concentric circles, but after coming down, he would become more involved than ever in sensuality. A close friend of Chuck's had suddenly gone homosexual that summer, leaving Chuck disgusted and cynical. Someone told Chuck that an Indian Swami was staying downtown on 2nd Avenue, and so he came one day in August to the window of the former Matchless Gifts store. Steve Guarino, who became Satswaroop, the son of a New York fireman, had grown up in the city and graduated from Brooklyn College in 1961. Influenced by his father, he had gone into the Navy, where he had tolerated 2 years of military routine, always waiting for the day he'd be free to join his friends on the Lower East Side. Finally, a few months after the death of President Kennedy, he had been honorably discharged. Without so much as paying a visit to his parents, he headed straight for the Lower East Side, which by then appeared vividly within his mind to be the most mystical place in the world. He was writing stories and short novels under the literary influence of Franz Kafka and others, and he began to take LSD to search and experiment with consciousness. A Love Supreme, a record by John Coltrane, the jazz musician, encouraged Steve to think that God actually existed. Just to make enough money to live, Steve had taken a job with the welfare office. One afternoon, during his lunch hour, while walking down 2nd Avenue, he saw that the Matchless Gift Store had a small piece of paper in the window announcing lectures in Bhagavad Gita, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. Chuck, I finally found 2nd Avenue and 1st Street, and I saw through the window that there was some chanting going on inside, and some people were sitting up against the wall. Beside me on the sidewalk, some middle-class people were looking in and giggling. I turned to them, and with my palms folded, I asked, "Is this where a Swami is?" They giggled and said, "Pilgrim, your search has ended." I wasn't surprised by this answer, because I felt it was the truth. Bruce and Chuck, unknown to one another, lived only 2 blocks apart. After the suggestion from his friend, Bruce also made his way to the storefront. "Bruce, I was looking for Hare Krishna. I had left my apartment and walked over to Avenue B when I decided to walk all the way down to Houston Street. When I came to First Street, I turned right, and then, walking along First Street, came to Second Avenue. All along First Street, I was seeing these Puerto Rican grocery stores, and then there was one of those churches where everyone was standing up, singing loudly, and playing tambourines. Then as I walked further along First Street, I had the feeling that I was leaving the world. Like when you're going to the airport to catch a plane. I thought, now I'm leaving a part of me behind, and I'm going to something new. But when I got over to Second Avenue, I couldn't find Hare Krishna. There was a gas station, and then I walked past a little storefront, but the only sign was one that said Matchless Gifts. Then I walked back again past the store, and in the window I saw a black and white sign announcing a Bhagavad Gita lecture. I entered the storefront and saw a pile of shoes there, so I took off my shoes and came in and sat down near the back. So that was Bruce, Brahmananda. Steve, Satsarup. I had a feeling that this was a group that was already established and had been meeting for a while. I came in and sat down on the floor, and a boy who said his name was Roy was very courteous and friendly to me. He seemed to be one who had already experienced the meetings. He asked me my name, and I felt at ease. Suddenly the Swami entered, coming through the side door. He was wearing a saffron dhoti but no shirt, just a piece of cloth like a long sash, tied in a knot across his right shoulder and leaving his arms, his left shoulder, and part of his chest bare. When I saw him, I thought of the Buddha, Bruce. There were about 15 people sitting on the floor. One man with a big beard sat up by the front on the right-hand side, leaning up against the wall. After some time, the door on the opposite side opened and in walked the Swami. When he came in, he turned his head to see who was in his audience, and then he stared right at me. Our eyes met. It was as if he was studying me. In my mind, it was like a photograph was being taken of Swamiji looking at me for the first time. There was a pause. Then he very gracefully got up on the dais and sat down and took out a pair of hand cymbals and began a kirtan. The kirtan was the thing that most affected me. It was the best music I'd ever heard, and it had meaning. You could actually concentrate on it, and it gave you some joy to repeat the words, Hare Krishna. I immediately accepted it as a spiritual practice. Chuck. I entered the storefront, and sitting on a grass mat on the hard floor was a person who seemed at first to be neither male nor female, but when he looked at me, I couldn't even look him straight in the eyes. They were so brilliant and glistening. His skin was golden with rosy cheeks, and he had large ears that framed his face. He had three strands of beads, one which was at his neck, one a little longer, and the other down on his chest. He had a long forehead which rose above his shining eyes, and there were many furrows in his brow. His arms were slender and long. His mouth was rich and full, and very dark and red and smiling, and his teeth were brighter than his eyes. He sat in a cross-legged position that I'd never seen before in any yoga book, and had never seen any yogi perform. It was a sitting posture, but his right foot was crossed over the thigh and brought back past his left hip, and one knee rested on the other directly in front of him. His every expression and gesture was different from those of any other personality I'd ever seen, and I sensed that they had meanings that I did not know, from a culture and a mood that were completely beyond this world. There was a mole on his side and a peculiar callus on his ankle, a round callus similar to what a karate expert develops on his knuckle. He was dressed in unhemmed cloth, dyed saffron. Everything about him was exotic, and his whole effulgence made him seem to be not even sitting in the room, but projected from some other place. He was so brilliant in color that it was like a technicolor movement, and yet he was right there. I heard him speaking. He was sitting right there before me, yet it seemed that if I reached out to touch him, he wouldn't be there. At the same time, seeing him was not an abstract or subtle experience, but a most intense presence. Hare Krishna. Any comment?
I was going to say that I shouldn't say that. Maybe keep on hitting on LSD.
Yeah.
And one, God just was saying, he was suggesting. He suggested that, that he was saying it was an interesting thing that.
Well, you know, it's described in the book. In this chapter, or somewhere around, I think in this chapter, how some members of the group, the Fugs, remember them? The Fugs. They were really, really sort of degraded. They came to 26 Second Avenue with some of their people, because they were, you know, kind of big people in the hippie scene. And Prabhupada was giving a class, and somehow the Prabhupada got onto the subject of taking LSD, and things like that, and speaking against it. And this fellow, some fellow from the Fugs, I think interrupted Prabhupada. Or anyway, at some point he asked the question, you know, like, you're saying we shouldn't take LSD, but have you ever tried it? And Prabhupada said, no. And the Fugs, a local group that had made a name for themselves, specialized in obscene lyrics. So it's in here. It's just, it must be. I mean, it was in here somewhere. Maybe not. Okay, anyway. So, have you ever tried it? Prabhupada said, no. And then he said, well, you know, how can you say anything? How can you criticize it? You don't even know what it is. Mm-hmm. And some of his, the people who were with him, they were like, yeah, you got him. Good point. And Prabhupada said, you don't need to eat stool to know that it tastes bad. Unless they've dropped it. There's a couple of mentions of the Fugs. Okay. Any other comments, questions? Srila Prabhupada ki.